The music on Donahue's office line is awful, and I feel a flare of irritation. My face feels angry hot. I've always considered myself a disciplined, deliberate person. A long-suffering, patient, logical, unemotional scientist. But obviously, I'm not patient enough, nowhere near patient enough. And my thoughts race as images flash. I keep seeing Carrie Grethen's face, the stoniness of her skin as pale as paper, and the way her eyes changed color and shading during her lecture, her soliloquy. Deep blue, then aqua, then icy pale, like a Siberian husky, and next her irises were so dark they looked almost black. I was seeing what was going on in her psyche, the shadings of her monster, of her spiritual malignancy. And I take another deep breath and blow out slowly. The video and its abrupt ending had the effect of a triple shot of espresso, or maybe a large dose of digitalis. My heart is about to beat its way out of my chest. I feel poisoned. I feel so many things I can't begin to describe them. And I take deep, slow breaths. I open up my lungs and breathe in and out deeply, very slowly and quietly, as I wait for Donahue. Finally, I hear a click on the line, and the music stops. "What's happening, Kay?" Jill Donahue gets right to it. "Nothing good, or I wouldn't be calling like this. I apologize for interrupting." I move a few steps, and my right thigh reminds me it's there. "What can I do for you? And what's the noise? Is that a helicopter? Where are you?" "It's an FBI helicopter, most likely," I reply. "I take it you're at a crime scene. I'm on Lucy's property, which is being treated like a crime scene. I would like to retain you as my attorney, Jill. I'd like to do so immediately." I watch Lucy sitting some distance away on a bench, pretending she isn't interested in my conversation. "Certainly we can talk about that later, but what's happening?" Donahue starts to say. "For the record, we're talking about it now," I interrupt her. "Please make a note of it. On August 15th at 10 minutes past 11 a.m., I hired you as my attorney and asked you to represent Lucy, too, assuming you're amenable." "So the three of us are protected by attorney-client privilege," she considers. "Except you aren't protected if you talk to Lucy without me present." "I understand. I'm about to believe nothing is privileged or private anyway." "That's probably a smart attitude to adopt this day and age. For now, the answer is yes about representation. But if there's a conflict, I'll have to withdraw from representing one of you." "Fair enough. Can you talk now?" "Lucy says where I am right this minute is safe. My guess is most of her property isn't. And the same may be true of my phone, if they've wiretapped into it. It may be true of my office email. I have no idea what's safe, to be honest." "Has Lucy talked to the FBI? Has she so much as said good morning?" "She's been cooperating with them to a degree. I'm afraid she's too comfortable." I look up at the helicopter and imagine the agents inside looking back. "I'm not happy that she didn't call you right away." "That wasn't a good idea, but I know her. It's her nature to underestimate them. She absolutely shouldn't." Lucy is now pacing, looking at her phone, texting, and she must not have serious worries about the FBI accessing her email or anything else. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, and I don't envy anybody who decides to intrude upon her privacy. She'll treat it as a challenge, as a competition. She's happy to return the favor. I can only imagine the cyber mischief and destruction she's capable of if she puts her mind to it. And I remember the look in Carrie's eyes as she said how spoiled Lucy was. The video clip I just watched continues playing in my mind. I can't make it stop. I can't shake Carrie's mockery, her grandiose self-absorption and bottomless pit of hate, and it's outrageous and wrong that I'm subjected to any of it. I feel saddened, angered, and undone in a way that's hard to define. I wonder if that's the real point in subjecting me to this. And then I have another thought. If I tell anyone, including Jill Donahue, there will be the problem of credibility. No one will believe me, and for good reason. The links texted to me are dead. It's impossible to prove they were ever connected to recordings made by Carrie Grethen or anyone else. Who besides you is on the property? Donahue continues to ask me questions, to prep herself before she heads out the door. Marino, Janet and their adopted son Desi, I reply. Well, he's not officially adopted yet. His mother, Janet's sister, died of pancreatic cancer 3 weeks ago. Donahue says she's deeply sorry to hear it, and whenever she attempts to show empathy or kindness, she gets a certain tone in her voice. It reminds me of a piano key that's a little flat, or the dull clink of cheap glass. Her walking around in another person's moccasins is a well-oiled act. Unfortunately, she doesn't mean it, and I go out of my way never to forget that her charisma, her alleged sympathy, are a rubber chicken. You hungrily sink your teeth into it and discover it's fake. What about Janet and Lucy? Donahue asks. Are they married? I'm caught by surprise and feel another wave of misgiving and maybe shame as I reply, actually, I don't know. You don't know if the niece you've raised like a daughter is married? They've never said anything, not to me. But you would know if they are. Not necessarily. It wouldn't be unlike Lucy to get married in secret. But I'd be surprised, I explain. It wasn't all that long ago that she told Janet to move out. Why? Lucy fears for Janet's safety, for Desi's safety. I glance at Lucy, making sure she can't hear me. She's standing with her back to me as she looks at something on her phone. Aren't they safer with her? Donahue asks. It doesn't seem Lucy thought so several months ago. Married people can kick each other out of the house. You don't have to be unmarried to have that happen. Which brings me back to the same thing. I don't know what they are. I don't know if they're protected by spousal privilege. You'll have to ask them. Does Janet know she shouldn't say a word to the FBI? Donahue asks. Because they'll try to trick her into chatting, into anything they possibly can. If they ask her what time it is or what she ate for breakfast, she's not to tell them. Janet is former FBI. She's an attorney. She knows how to handle them. Yes, yes, I know. Both she and Lucy are former FBI, meaning they're overly confident about their ability to handle the FBI. Does Benton know what's happening? I'm assuming he must. I have no idea. I don't want to. It's yet one more unthinkable possibility. A strong possibility. In fact, it's hard to imagine Benton didn't know his own family was about to be raided. How could he not have known? This isn't a spontaneous event. The feds planned it. I saw him in court early this morning at a status hearing, Donahue adds. I started to say he acted as if everything is fine, but he always acts like that. Yes, he does. I don't recall Benton telling me he had court this morning. And you haven't told him where you are right now and what's happening, Donahue makes sure, and he's given you no reason to suspect he knows. Benton and I had coffee together. We spent a few quiet minutes on our sun porch before both of us got ready for work, and I envision his handsome face, conjuring it up from hours earlier. He didn't, I reply. I didn't detect the faintest shadow of anything that might have been bothering him. But Benton is stoical. He's one of the most unreadable people I've ever met. What's the likelihood he doesn't know, Kay? There's no likelihood. And that's probably the dismal truth, because how could he not have had a clue that his colleagues were about to raid Lucy's property and seize her belongings? Of course he knew. And how could he not be bothered by that fact? How could he sleep in the same bed and make love to me while knowing such a thing was about to happen? I feel a twinge of anger, of betrayal, and then I feel nothing. This is our life together. We have more non-conversations than any two people I know. We routinely keep secrets from each other. At times we lie. It might be by omission, but we deliberately mislead each other and misrepresent the truth because that's what our jobs require. At moments like this, as an FBI helicopter beats overhead and agents raid my niece's property, I wonder if it's worth it. Benton and I answer to a higher power that's actually a lower one. We faithfully serve a criminal justice system that's flawed and compromised on its way to being broken. I've not talked to him since we left the house this morning, I summarized to Donahue. I've told him nothing. Let's leave it like that for now, she says. And after a weighty beat, she adds, I have a question for you, Kay, while we're on the subject. Have you ever heard the term data fiction? Data fiction? I repeat. And Lucy turns around and stares in my direction as if she heard what I just said. No, I haven't. Why? It's a term that's central to a case I was just in court about this morning. Not a case that has any direct relevance to you, per se. Well, we'll talk when I see you. I'm on my way. Chapter 15. I end the call and lean against the dogwood tree, thinking. The helicopter is a huge, menacing black hornet. It's been nosing low and loud over the river, going up and down, then cutting hard left or right, flying a grid pattern as if searching for someone. I feel sunlight on the back of my neck as I look around at the freshly mown grass and lush trees. The meadow beyond the rock garden is a paint-spattered canvas of bold primary colors and electric mixtures of them. It's breathtakingly beautiful in this spot. It's supposed to be peaceful. But the FBI has turned it into a war zone, and I realize how alone I am. I can't confide in anyone, not really, and especially not Benton. Jill Donahue was in a status hearing early this morning and ran into him. What business took him to the federal courthouse in Boston, and why didn't he mention it before we both left for work? What really gnaws at me is that Donahue brought up something called the data fiction in the context of why I just called her. What does it have to do with Lucy or me or any of us? Was she simply referencing something that was on her mind? I twist around and look up at the helicopter banking east, swooping around, thundering over Lucy's house directly toward us. Are we ready? Lucy's face is stone. I can't be sure that she didn't overhear my conversation. I have no idea what she really knows. Yes, we should go, I reply. And we set out for the house together. Before we say another word to each other, let me remind you that whatever is communicated between the two of us isn't privileged. That's nothing new, Aunt Kay. So I want to be very careful what I ask or tell you, Lucy. I just want to make sure you understand that. Thick grass makes a brushing sound against my boots, and the humidity is fast approaching the dew point. In another hour or so, we're going to have a Noah's Ark downpour. I know all about privilege. She glances over at me. What do you want to know? Ask me while you can. In a few minutes, it won't be safe to have this conversation. Jill Donahue mentioned something about a case involving data fiction. I'm curious if you have any idea what she might have been referring to, because I'm not familiar with the term. Data fiction is a trending concept on the undernet, the underground of the internet. The undernet, where most of what goes on is illegal? Depends on who you're talking to. For me, it's just an extreme frontier of cyberspace, like the Wild Wild West. Just another place to data mine and send my search engines loose. Tell me about data fiction. It's what can happen if we're so reliant on technology that we become completely dependent on things we can't see. Therefore, we can no longer judge for ourselves what's true, what's false, what's accurate, what isn't. In other words, if reality is defined by software that does all the work for us, then what if this software lies? What if everything we believe isn't true but is a facade, a mirage? What if we go to war, pull the plug, make life and death decisions based on data fiction? I'd say that happens more than we'd like to imagine, I reply. It's certainly something I worry about every time we generate our annual crime statistics and the government makes decisions based on our data. Imagine armed drones controlled by unreliable software. A click of the mouse and you blow up the wrong person's house. I don't have to imagine it, I reply. I'm afraid it's happened. Or how about financial misinformation and manipulation? Something far worse than a Ponzi scheme. Think about all those online transactions and digital reads of what you have in your bank accounts. You believe you have a certain amount of cash, assets, or debt because it says so right there on your computer screen or in your quarterly report that was generated by software. What if this software creates data that accounts for every penny, but in fact it's false? What if it's a front for fraud? Then you have data fiction. And right now, there's a case in federal court involving that. I'm walking slowly and uphill again. Apparently, Jill Donahue has something to do with it. Benton might have something to do with it, too. Do you need to stop for a minute, Aunt Kay? Lucy pauses to wait up for me. We need to work on what you call me. You can't keep calling me Aunt Kay. Then what? Kay. Feels strange. Dr. Scarpetta. Chief. Hey, you. Something besides Aunt Kay. You're not a kid. Both of us are adults. You seem to be hurting a lot, Lucy says. We need to get you someplace where you can sit down. Don't worry about me. I'm all right. You're hurting. You're not all right. Sorry I'm so damn slow. The pain in my leg is a radiating throb that I've gotten used to for the most part. Each week I'm better, but I can't move fast. Stairs are difficult. Standing on the hard tile in the autopsy room hours on end is miserable. But vigorous activity, such as trudging uphill in extreme heat and humidity, would be considered off-limits so soon. I'm not supposed to get my blood pressure up. When I do, I'm reminded that bone is living tissue, and the longest, heaviest bone in the human body is the femur. It has two super nerves, the femoral and the sciatic, that run from the lower back to the knee like high-speed trains carrying pain along their tracks. I stop walking for a moment and rub my thigh, gently massaging the muscles. You should use a cane, Lucy says. God, no. I'm serious. She glances at me, at my leg as I resume walking stiffly. You're at a disadvantage. You can't outrun anyone, and at least if you had a sturdy walking stick, a cane, you could use it as a weapon. That sounds like the logic of a 7-year-old, like something Desi would say. Looking so obviously wounded and vulnerable makes you an easy target. Bad people smell your weakness like a shark smells blood. Metaphorically, it's the wrong message. I've already been an easy target once this summer for a shark of sorts. It won't happen again, and I have a pistol in my bag. I sound a little winded. Don't let them see it. They'd love an excuse to shoot us. That's not funny. Do I look like I'm laughing? Her house comes into view. Timber and glass, with a copper roof on a rise overlooking a part of the river as wide as a bay. The helicopter is over the woods again, very low this time, and treetops churn in the downwash. "What the hell are they looking for?" I ask.
"They want the recording,"
Lucy says matter-of-factly, and I'm shocked. I stop on the driveway and stare at her.
"What recording?"
"They think I have it hidden somewhere, maybe buried like treasure, maybe in some secret bunker. I mean, really," she says derisively. "They think I'm going to tuck the camera into a little metal box and dig a hole and whoa, it's safe? If I don't want them to find something, they won't in a million years."
"What recording?"
"I can guarantee you, they're using ground-penetrating radar, looking for geologic parameters that might tell them if I have something hidden below ground."
Lucy's attention is fixed on the helicopter. So loud and close, we're having to shout.
"Next, they'll probably show up with fucking backhoes just so they can have the pleasure of destroying my landscaping. Because more than anything, this is revenge. This is putting me in my place."
"What recording?"
I expect her next to admit that the depraved heart video clips were sent to her, too.
"The one from Florida."
She means the recording of my being shot while diving a shipwreck off the coast of Fort Lauderdale 2 months ago.
"There's nothing helpful in it, but I guess they don't know that. It depends on what they're really looking for," she says, as I realize she's been lying to me. To everyone. Or better yet, what they're not looking for, which is the more likely story. And I can't give them that bonus. I'm pretty sure I know what it is, and they won't get it courtesy of me.
My scuba mask with its embedded mini recorder is missing. Or I thought it was. It was never recovered after Carrie tried to kill me. Or that's what I've been led to believe. The explanation I've been given is that finding it wasn't the top priority. Saving my life was. By the time divers searched for the mask, the current had moved it and possibly covered it with silt. They wanted that recording 2 months ago. I'm careful what I say. Why is this coming up now?
Before now, it was theoretical. They're convinced I have it.
The FBI is convinced, I reply, and she nods.
Based on what?
How can you know what they're convinced of? When I flew back from Bermuda recently, I landed at Logan, and within minutes, customs police were all over my plane.
Stop.
I hold up my hand and pause on the driveway again.
Before you continue, why would the feds care if you were in Bermuda? Why would they be monitoring you there?
Maybe because of who they suspected I was seeing.
I think of Carrie as I ask,
and who was that?
I was seeing a friend of Janet's. No one you need to concern yourself with.
I'd say there's a need for me to concern myself, since it would seem this person is someone the FBI is interested in. And they'll just keep on snooping around in case Carrie really does exist. And if she doesn't, then who did this to my leg? I tamp down a flare of anger.
Long story short, the FBI sicked customs on me. They went through everything on my plane and asked me a long list of questions about my trip, about why I was traveling, and had I been scuba diving? They held me for well over an hour, and I have no doubt about the point of it. They were instructed to look for the mask, for recording devices. In other words, for items the FBI had interest in, but didn't want to tip their hand about with me. The FBI couldn't crawl all over my plane and go through my luggage to their heart's content without drawing huge attention, but customs could. I don't know how Lucy could have gotten a hold of my scuba mask. And next, I think of Benton. If he found it and never turned it in, he would be guilty of tampering with evidence, obstruction of justice, anything his FBI compatriots might hurl at him.
Should we be...
I don't finish the question as I make a point of looking at lampposts, at the cameras mounted on them. I've been knocking out the audio of every camera we pass. I'm sure they know I'm doing it. As soon as I get inside, they'll take my phone so I can't tamper with my own security system, Lucy says. They were going through my scuba gear earlier. But you weren't diving with me when it happened. They'll make a case I was. That's ridiculous. You weren't even in Florida. Prove it. They're making a case that you were with me when I was shot? You were on that dive? How could they possibly make a case for that? You weren't with us. Who will irrefutably prove I wasn't? She continues to push her point. Benton and you? Because everyone else isn't talking. What she means is the two police divers who had gone down to the wrecked barge first were murdered. I'm not aware of any witnesses to my being shot except Benton and the one who did it, Carrie. They believe I have your dive mask, Lucy says. Do you? Not exactly. Not exactly? The instant you activated the camera on your mask, she says, it began to live stream to a designated site. I think of Bermuda again. I think of Janet's friend, whom Lucy supposedly was seeing. What site? I ask. We won't get into that. Now we're up to two things you won't tell me. The person you met in Bermuda, and where the video was live streamed. That's right. Well, I'm not aware that anybody has my mask, I add. And her answer is silence. And her house is very close now. To my knowledge, it's never been found. The first priority, of course, was keeping me alive when they got me into the boat. Plus, there was an underwater crime scene to work, a double homicide. I envisioned the two speared bodies in the hatch of the sunken barge, the police divers killed just moments before Benton and I took our giant stride off the boat. When I found them, I knew I was next. And then Carrie appeared around a section of the rusting hulk. I hear the faint buzzing sound of her being propelled through the water toward me, and the clink of the first spear hitting my tank, then the shock when the second one impaled my thigh. There were bodies to recover, in addition to any gear I might have lost after I was shot, I remind Lucy. It was hours before the sunken barge and the area around it were thoroughly searched, and I've always been told my mask was never found. I keep saying that. But they know it existed, Lucy replies. They know about the mask you had on when Carrie supposedly attacked you, and that's the problem. They were told about it. Supposedly attacked? That's the way they look at it. Yes, Lucy says. They know there was a mini recorder attached to your mask, and that it might stand to reason the video captured on that dive was live streamed, possibly to me. They would assume I was sitting somewhere with a device that was capturing everything happening to you. Why would they assume such a thing? Because they would. There must be more of a reason than that. I get an increasingly unsettled feeling. Tell me what it is, I say, as the feeling is stronger, fluttering through my chest. The reason is you, Lucy says. And now I remember. You mentioned the mask in interviews. You told the FBI that I'd installed a mini recorder on the mask you had on when Carrie shot you, so there should be an irrefutable record of exactly what happened. Except there isn't. What do you mean there isn't? Do you remember telling me about it after they talked to you in the hospital? Barely. Do you remember telling the FBI about the mask and its capabilities? Barely. I don't really recall what I said to Lucy, to the feds, to anyone. Those initial conversations are disjointed and dreamlike, and I can't retrieve the questions or my answers word for word. But I know I would have told the truth if asked, especially if I were injured and medicated, if I were as out of it as I must have been. I would have had no reason to feel it was unsafe to relay precisely what I knew or thought I did, never imagining the information would be used against us.
I couldn't have anticipated that 2 months later the FBI would be crawling all over Lucy's property and searching it from the air. I'm sorry if I've caused you trouble. In fact, not if. Clearly I have, I say to her. You haven't. It would appear that I have made things worse somehow, I reply, and we're almost to her sidewalk. I'm very sorry, Lucy, because it certainly wasn't my intention. You have nothing to be sorry about, and now we stop talking. 3, 2, 1, and the audio is back on. She touches an app on her phone, looks at me, and nods. Our privacy is gone, just like that. Chapter 16. As if on cue, a woman in khaki cargo pants and a dark polo shirt opens the front door. She could see us on the surveillance cameras, even if she couldn't hear what we were saying. The 40-caliber Glock and the shiny brass badge on Aaron Loria's belt overwhelm her thin frame, and I do an instant inventory. Shoulders slightly rounded on their way to hunched. Teeth straight and natural, with no discoloration due to enamel loss. Arms covered with lanugo fine dark hair. Anorexic versus bulimic. She'll have early osteoporosis and cardiac problems if she's not careful. She doesn't look familiar. I don't think I've ever seen her before, but I know who she is, all right. The special agent in charge, who may have had an affair with Carrie Grethen, watches us reach the stone sidewalk. We follow it as she looks on silently, her face framed by long black hair that is thinning prematurely at the temples and on the crown. She has a cockeyed smile that on her best day is insincere, and on her worst is condescending like it is right now. And I have to scrutinize closely to detect the scaffolding of a former beauty queen. I have to look carefully for the fine bone structure beneath sun-baked skin, the curves that have been replaced by raw bones and flat buttocks and sagging breasts. Her dark eyes are widely spaced, with bags underneath, and her pouty mouth has puppet lines. The remnants of her Barbie doll prettiness are rapidly eroding. And if I met her at Quantico when Lucy was there, I can't tell, and I'm pretty good at remembering people. There's no spark of recognition, and there would be had we been introduced, had I ever chatted with her. At most, we might have passed in the hallway. We may have been on the elevator at the same time. I don't know, and I don't care if she really was involved with Carrie sexually. What matters is what Lucy believed at the time, and it's stunningly inappropriate that Aaron Loria has led the raid on Lucy's property, that Aaron has anything at all to do with my niece. A curious conflict of interest comes to mind. I don't greet her in a friendly manner. Excuse me? Give it careful thought and you might know what I'm talking about. I don't offer to shake her hand. It's impossible not to think about what I witnessed on film. And I envision Lucy beside herself with hurt and jealousy after Aaron showed up on the Yellow Brick Road obstacle course. It wasn't a coincidence. It would seem Carrie and Aaron were having a relationship right under Lucy's nose, and I can't imagine what must have gone through Lucy's mind when 17 years later, Aaron shows up on her private property with a warrant. I'm Kay Scarpetta, the chief medical examiner. Yes, I know. I'm just making sure you do. I can show you identification if need be, I say, as she blocks the doorway, not budging an inch in any direction. I believe you and Lucy have already met. I add a sting of irony. I know who you are, and I know your niece. I'm sure you're aware we go back a long way. That maddening smile again as she stares at Lucy. It's nice to see you didn't run off. I'm sure that's the real reason you have the helicopter up, in case I try to escape from my own property. That sounds like the FBI's brilliant thinking. Lucy has a way of sounding bored when she's contemptuous.
A glib remark. I said it lightly, tongue in cheek. Aaron's clever humor comes across as haughty. Of course you wouldn't be so silly as to run off. I was teasing. Let me guess who's flying. Lucy looks up at the military black twin-engine bird. John. 6'5" with the 310 steroid body. Big John, who has the light touch of a Mack truck. You should have seen him setting down on the dolly the other day at that hangar your people use at Hanscom. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you not know it's common knowledge the FBI has a secret special ops hangar at Hanscom Air Force Base? That big, tax-dollar-subsidized, recently refurbished hangar next to Medflight? Anyway, Lucy continues to needle her about the FBI's not-so-secret hangar just outside of Boston. It took Big John 3 tries to get your bird centered on the dolly. Skids all wackadoo, one of them touching down and bouncing off like a wobbly puppy feeling for the next step when it's learning to do the stairs. I can always tell when it's Big John on the stick. I could give him some pointers about over-controlling. You know, think it, don't touch it, that sort of thing. I can see thoughts racing behind Erin's eyes. She's incensed and trying to figure out her best comeback. I don't give her the chance. I'd like to enter my niece's house. I look past her into a vast open space of timber and glass soaring over the water. Perfect, Erin says without stepping aside. Because I need to ask you a few questions. I take in the dusty footprints all over the deep red cherry floors, the stacks of white banker boxes against a wall. Inside the living room, the lamps are missing their mica shades, and the mission-style furniture has been carelessly rearranged, the cushions sloppily replaced. I noticed the takeout coffee cups and crumpled food bags on top of tables and scattered over the hand-carved African mahogany fireplace mantel. Empty sugar packets and stirring sticks fill an art glass bowl I bought for Lucy in Murano. In the space of 2 short hours, it looks as if a small army has been tromping through her Architectural Digest spread. The FBI is giving her the finger back. More precisely, her former doormate is. You can save any questions for Jill Donahue, I let Erin know. She'll be here soon. And in the world I come from, I meet her cool customer stare. We don't eat or drink at scenes. We don't bring in coffee, help ourselves to water or the bathroom. We certainly don't leave our detritus. It looks like you've forgotten basic crime scene training, which is surprising. Since you're married to a judge, you should know better than most that lapses in protocol can come back to haunt you in court. Please come in, Erin says, as if she lives here, and I didn't just say what I did. I'm going to check on everyone. Lucy starts to walk away. Not so fast. Erin lightly grips her arm. You need to get your hands off me, Lucy says quietly. How's your leg? Erin asks me as she continues to hold on to Lucy's arm only harder. When I heard about it, my first thought was, how did you manage not to drown? And by the way, Zeb sends his regards. I'm sure Judge Nodos misses me like a hole in the head. What I say is, and please give him mine. I'm asking you politely to get your hands off me, Lucy says. And Erin realizes the wisdom of letting her go. It looks like walking is pretty hard for you these days. Erin turns her attention to me. You were what? Some 90 feet, 100 feet down and lost consciousness? If someone shot me with a spear gun, I'm sure I'd pass out. It will be a while before my leg is back to normal, but I'm expecting a full recovery. It sounds stilted. And it's supposed to when I recite what I scripted long, painful weeks ago. That's the only question I'm going to answer before Jill Donahue gets here. Sure, have it your way. But I don't see anyone here trying to Mirandize you, Dr. Scarpetta. We're not interrogating you, just asking for a little helpful guidance. Then she says to Lucy, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to take your phone. I've been nice about it. I could have taken it when I got here, but I didn't. I gave you the benefit of the doubt, and what do? You tamper with the security system. It's not the security system, Lucy says. It's my security system. I can do whatever I want with it. I gave you the benefit of the doubt, Aaron repeats. And the thanks I get is you interfere with our investigation. She takes the phone from Lucy. Now I'm not nice about it anymore. Your benefit of the doubt was to let me keep it long enough to see who I might contact and what else I might do as you tap into everything you think I have, Lucy says. And I thank you for that. It was helpful to me to see what you're interested in, but not so helpful to you. What you really want is usernames and passwords, and getting those hasn't happened, has it? And guess what? It never will. The NSA, the CIA couldn't break through my firewalls. But someone did. It appears someone, most likely Carrie, is spoofing Lucy's cell phone and has gotten into her computer system, her wireless network, and that in turn would compromise her home security system. Everything in Lucy's world is part of a web too complex for me to comprehend. Her networks have networks, her servers have servers, and her proxies have proxies. The fact is that no one really knows what she does and just how extensive her range might be. And if someone is hacking into her privacy, even if Carrie is, then I have to wonder if Lucy has allowed it. She may have invited it. If offered a cyber challenge, her reaction is to bring it on. She believes she'll win. We can get into anything we want, Aaron boasts to her. But if you're smart, you'll decide to cooperate. You'll give us whatever we need, including passwords. The more difficult you make this, the worse off you're gonna be. Now I'm really scared. Lucy's tone has a dry ice bite, and I'm reminded of her in the video sarcastically saying to Carrie, I'm scared. Lucy wasn't. Not the way anybody else would be. You always were too sure of yourself. Aaron bars the doorway with her arm, and I'm deciding what she's doing right now is for my benefit. It's amazing. She's showing off. I would smile if anything right now were funny. It's what got you into trouble the first time, Aaron says to Lucy. The first time? Lucy watches the helicopter circle her property again. Let me try to figure out when that was. Let's see. When did I get in trouble the first time? I was probably 2 or 3, or maybe hadn't been born yet. I can see you're determined to make this as difficult as possible. 600-700 feet in this heat and humidity with what I'm sure is a heavy payload? Lucy hasn't taken her eyes off the helicopter now hovering low over the woods next to the house. Let me guess. At least 6 people in back. Probably musclehead guys with a lot of gear. But I wouldn't be hanging out in the dead man's curve if I were Big John. Good luck auto-rotating in an emergency. And if I were him, I'd already be back on the ground with this weather rolling in. You might want to radio Big John and tell him that, and also remind him he's got maybe 30 minutes of decent viz left before it rapidly deteriorates to special VFR on its way to nothing. He might want to get the hell back to Hanscom while the getting's good and tuck your expensive custom bird into its custom hangar because there's a chance of hail. You've not changed. You're the same arrogant... Aaron starts to say something vulgar and stops herself. Arrogant what? Lucy meets her eyes. You're the same as you always were. Aaron glares at her and then says to me, Your niece and I were at Quantico at the same time. Funny, I don't remember you. Lucy lies easily, convincingly. Maybe you can show me an old class photo. Point yourself out. You remember me well enough. I don't. Lucy looks innocent. You do. And I remember you. And from that, I'm supposed to assume you know me? I know enough. Aaron says it to her, while she looks at me. The fact is you don't know me, Lucy says. You don't know shit about me. Now isn't the time for me to give Lucy a lecture, but if I could, I'd tell her how unsafe it is to talk this way. Her anger has blown her cover. Her anger has asserted itself and given the FBI further incentive to clip her wings or cage her. I'd like to see the warrant, I say to Aaron. This isn't your property. Some of my personal possessions, including possible case-related materials, are inside this house. You might want to be careful about compromising something that could cause you a problem. Start with this. You're only here because I'm allowing it. Aaron has decided to turn this into a competition. Because I'm being friendly and inclusive. I dig inside my shoulder bag and pull out a pen and legal pad. I'm just doing the same thing you are, making notes. I'm not writing anything. She holds up her empty hands. But you will. I glance at my watch. It's 25 minutes past 11 on Friday morning, August 15th. We are in the foyer of Lucy's house in Concord. I write it down. And I've just asked Special Agent Aaron Loria for the warrant because I also am an occupant of this house. Not full-time, but I have an apartment here that contains personal possessions and confidential information, so I'd like to see the warrant. It's not your house. To quote the Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, I reply, people have a right to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. I'd like to see the warrant to make sure it's properly signed by a judge and that the judge doesn't happen to be Special Agent Aaron Loria's husband, the Honorable Zeb Chase. That's ridiculous, she interrupts me. He's in Virginia. He's a federal judge, and theoretically could sign off on any federal court order you request. Of course, it would be unethical. I'm jotting notes. I'd like to see the warrant. I've asked you 3 times. I underline it for emphasis. Chapter 17. It's the usual document. Nothing clever or unexpected. The search and seizure warrant lists everything but the kitchen sink, including secret hatches, doors, rooms, and egresses that may or may not be attached to the main residence and its outbuildings. The inventory of what the FBI has nabbed so far includes long guns, handguns, ammunition and reloading tools, and knives and cutting, stabbing instruments of all descriptions, dive and boat gear, electronic recording equipment, computers, external hard drives, and any other form of electronic storage. The legal wish list also includes possible sources of biological evidence, specifically DNA. And I find that odd. Not that anything this day is even close to normal. It's on my mind that the FBI has Lucy's DNA. She used to work for them. They have her DNA profile and fingertips on file, and also Janet's, Marino's, and mine, for exclusionary purposes. I assume they have no interest in 7-year-old Desi. He has nothing to do with anything. And I don't understand exactly what the agents are hoping for. But clearly they aren't done yet. And because they're hell-bent to help themselves to every computer and whatever's on them, I'm forced to consider another grim scenario. What if the feds are looking for a way to access confidential information at my headquarters, the Cambridge Forensic Center? Lucy is the skeleton key to everything we do at the CFC. She's the keeper of my electronic kingdom, and therefore potentially a portal for the feds. They could attempt to use her to gain access to office email accounts and case records that go back many decades, and next I start wondering why they might care. I wonder why the helicopter followed me here. Did it really? Or did it just seem like it? Is the FBI only after Lucy? Are they after her at all? Or is it me they want? The CFC's cases and all investigative and laboratory documents related are classified. I hand the warrant back to Aaron Loria. They're protected by state and federal law, and you can't exploit Lucy's position on my staff and use it as a means to access the CFC's proprietary information. You know how improper that would be. I don't say illegal, because the FBI would make sure it isn't. They would twist and permute the truth to justify their every move. Going up against them is worse than David and Goliath. It's David without a rock and Goliath with an assault rifle. But knowing that never scares me from a fight with government officials. I don't forget they're supposed to work for the people and aren't a law unto themselves, even if they act like it. I'm always outnumbered, and I never forget that either. You realize how seriously such a violation could impact every criminal case the CFC works, I add. I would be unable to ensure the integrity of any of our records, including thousands of those pertaining to federal cases, FBI cases. I think you're quite aware of the potential consequences. I also would venture a guess that the Department of Justice doesn't need any more news stories about privacy violations, about spying and screwed-up investigations. Are you threatening me with bad press? I'm reminding you of certain consequences of your potential actions. I repeat my careful phrasing as I follow her down a hallway of rich cherry paneling hung with Moreau paintings and lithographs. Your warrant to search my niece's property in no way grants you any rights to access the CFC, or to me personally, for that matter. Because if you do go to the press with anything about this, Loria says as we reach the master suite, I'll charge you with obstruction of justice. I've not threatened you in any way. I write it down. I'm the one feeling threatened. I write that, too. Why are you threatening me? I underline it. I'm not. It feels like it. And I respect your feelings. She has a notebook out now and is writing down what I'm saying, maybe out of self-defense. I never forget the Bureau is sly like a fox in its insistence on using primitive paper and pen to record what agents supposedly witness. They take notes. That way, it's easier to misrepresent what a suspect or a witness did or said. It's not enough for you to respect what I feel, I reply, and it's difficult to watch what's happening inside the master bedroom. You have no probable cause, no justification whatsoever to go through confidential medical examiner records or communications associated with them, some of which includes classified materials relating to our troops, our men and women in the military. You have no right to the emails and other communications of my staff or me. I understand your position, Aaron says. You'll understand it better if you place any of my cases in jeopardy, I reply, not so politely. And it's not a threat. It's a promise. I'll make a note you said that. Thank God Lucy isn't here to see the two female agents inside her walk-in closet, their gloved hands going through the pockets of everything she's ever worn, her jeans, her flight suits, her dress clothes. They're looking in her shoes, her boots, and riffling through briefcases and built-in drawers, while on the other side of the room, a male agent roots through Janet's closet and another removes artwork from the walls. Spectacular canvases and photographs of African wildlife. He props them up, pounds on paneling with the flat of his palm, looking for secret compartments, I can only guess, and I feel a knot in my stomach the size of a softball. This can be made so much easier if we have honest communication, Aaron is saying as I move to a window and open the shade. So much can be prevented if we get the truth about what's happened. About what happened? I don't turn around. In Florida, she says, we need the truth. You're implying that those of us involved are lying, as if it's your default position that everybody lies. I look out the window at the late morning because I'm not going to look at her. And you might be right. In your world, everybody probably does lie, including the organization you work for. In your world, the end justifies the means. You can do whatever you want, and truth is incidental, assuming you even recognize it. When you were injured in June, you mean when I was attacked. I scan the spacious backyard that drops off precipitously into a steep hillside thick with trees. When you were shot, I stipulate that there's ample evidence you were shot. You stipulate? Sounds like you're making a court case. Let me ask you, she interrupts, have you ever owned a spear gun? You can ask me that when Jill Donahue gets here. What about Lucy? She's obviously into weapons. Do you know how many firearms she stores in her vault? Would it surprise you if I told you almost 100? Why does she need so many guns? The answer, were I inclined to give it, is Lucy collects what she calls handcrafted small-batch weapons. She loves intricate technology, the art and science of every fine innovation, including those that kill. She's drawn to symbols of power, whether they're guns or cars or flying machines, and she collects because she can. There isn't much she can't afford. If she wants a Zev customized Glock or a 1911 hand-fitted for a lefty and exquisitely beautiful, she doesn't care what it costs. I don't answer Aaron's questions, but that doesn't stop her from asking them as I look out at light flickering on the water, at the gentle current and the 100-foot cypress dock with the teak and glass boathouse at the end. Lucy left to check on Janet, Desi, and Jet Ranger, and I encouraged her not to come back to the main house until Donahue arrives. I hope it's soon. I look for Marino, but don't see any sign of him. I'm not going to mince words with you, Kay, and I assume you don't mind my calling you that. I say nothing. I do mind. All we have to go on is what you claim happened, and what Benton claimed to have observed. You claim Carrie Grethen shot you. It's not what I claim, or what Benton claims. It's what is factual and true. I turn around and look at her. Your claim that Carrie Grethen shot you is based solely on your visual recognition of her, a woman you'd not seen in what, 13, 14 years at least, a woman whose death was witnessed. It wasn't exactly. I'll sure as hell tell her this much. Her death was assumed. We never actually saw her in the helicopter that crashed. Her remains were never found. There's no proof she died. In fact, there's proof to the contrary. And the FBI knows all this. I don't need to tell you your proof. Your speculative and fanciful proof, Aaron interrupts me again. You catch a glimpse of a person in a camouflage dive skin, and somehow you instantly knew who it was. A camouflage dive skin? I ask. That's an interesting detail. One you gave us. I don't say anything. I offer her an uncomfortable silence to fill. Maybe you don't remember. There's probably a lot you don't remember after a trauma like that, she says. How's your memory now, by the way? I've wondered if you went for a while underwater without breathing. I remain silent. That can have serious consequences for memory. I don't react. You claim the person who shot you had on a camo dive skin, she then says. The detail came from you. I don't recall saying that, but I might have because it's true. Of course you don't remember. Her voice oozes condescension. I don't remember telling your agents this, I reply. But I remember what I saw. Somehow you recognize this person presumed dead. She rephrases her argument about Carrie. Even though you'd not laid eyes on her or seen a photograph of her in more than a decade, you're positive in your identification of her, and I'm loosely quoting from your own sworn statement that you gave to our agents in Miami on June 17th while you were still in the hospital. A statement that wasn't recorded, I remind her, only written. What agents write down and what was actually said can be difficult to prove since there's no unimpeachable record. And I'm just wondering, how can we be sure my statement was sworn? You're saying if you didn't swear under oath to tell the truth, you might not... She's cut off by a familiar voice in the corridor. Hello, hello. That's enough. It's bad manners to start without me. Jill Donahue walks in smiling. Typically chic in one of her designer suits, this one midnight blue. Her wavy dark hair is shorter than when I saw her last. Other than that, she looks the same. Perpetually energetic and fresh, permanently somewhere between 35 and 50. I don't believe we've met. She introduces herself to Aaron, and a brief turf war ensues that the FBI isn't going to win. Then you're new to the Boston area, Donahue summarizes. So let me tell you how things work. When my client says she won't talk to you until I show up, you stop talking. We were having a casual discussion about her recognizing Carrie Grethen. See? Now that sounds like talking. And how she could have recognized her or anyone for that matter, considering how fast it happened, considering the extreme duress of the alleged situation. Alleged? Donahue almost laughs. Have you seen Dr. Scarpetta's leg? Show me. Aaron's eyes dancing with defiance. With her certainty, I'm not about to undress. But she couldn't be more mistaken. I unzip my cargo pants. Chapter 18. That's okay, she quickly says. You don't need to prove anything. In my profession, you give up modesty rather quickly. I ease the right pants leg down to my knee. When you've just finished working a decomp, a floater, you really don't care who's in the shower next to you. The entrance and exit scars are right here. I point to them, round and angry red and smaller than a dime. The spears skewered my quadriceps muscles, I explain. Entering here, almost mid-thigh, and exiting just above my patella, my kneecap. The tip protruded about 4 inches from my skin. Obviously, the significant damage was to muscle and bone, which were further injured because of the rope. One end was attached to the spear, and the other to a float on the surface. You can imagine the tugging and pulling. An awful thought. Very painful. Aaron pauses for effect. But it's within the realm of possibility. The wound could have been self-inflicted, prompting you to make up some imaginary story about some phantom in camouflage. I hold an imaginary spear gun and try to line up the tip with the entrance wound on my thigh. Difficult, but not impossible. What would be my motivation? You would do anything for your niece, wouldn't you? You don't have to answer that, Donahue says. I wouldn't, I reply. And I didn't shoot myself. And I don't know anything about a camo dive skin, but that doesn't mean Carrie wasn't wearing one. What if it meant saving Lucy's life? Would you lie? You don't have to answer that, Donahue says. Would you lie to cover the shameful fact that you were suicidal? It would be my nature to shoot the source of the threat, I reply. You aren't required to.